What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Straight Up Sabres, presented by the Hockey Podcast Network and the Charging Buffalo. As always, I'm Brendan.
And I'm Taylor.
And Taylor, Jeff Skinner skated in his 1,000th game on Tuesday night against the Washington Capitals, becoming the 13th Sabres skater ever to play in 1,000 games. And the Sabres celebrated the big night in style, picking up a commanding 6-2 victory. There were five Sabres skaters who ended up with multi-point games on the night. The top line looked fantastic. Jack Quinn looked like he was starting to get back to his usual form. And there was a lot of positives that could be taken from the game, especially when you consider in the early goings of things, it didn't look good as Washington got out to an early lead. But the moral of the story, the hallmark of the game was that the Sabres offense was buzzing in this one. Taylor, give me your thoughts on the game before we start talking about the Sabres offense a little bit in the bigger picture.
So I think one thing that's obvious to me at this point is there's a couple things, but the Sabres are at least as good as the Capitals. And really more than anything watching that game, it made me realize what a waste it is that they're not going to make the playoffs this year in a year where there's not a good eighth team in the Eastern Conference, or at least an eighth team that's playing up to its potential, like the Red Wings or Islanders. But the Capitals, man, especially, it seems like they really still might take that spot. And that's crazy to me because they aren't good at all at anything. And it was so clear watching it last night. It's like, does Lindgren have it? Then we might be able to win. What's a crazy thing to rely on? Charles Lindgren isn't Dominic Hasek. He's not even Thatcher Demko. So this is just, it's absurd to me that it's come to this. And I know the Capitals have been very lucky, but in any other year, they'd be lamenting their luck and being like, oh, we could have had a better draft spot or whatever, because they'd be in 12th or whatever, but not this year. More specifically with this game, it's a good example of how the Sabres offense can still be kind of electric in chances that they wanted to. And in general, that was just a game where the Sabres played with a mental toughness that they don't usually show. They got scored on first. They immediately came back and they looked like the better team for the rest of the first period. They could 3-1 lead in the second. They relentlessly forecheck to the point where it seems crazy that they don't have a fourth or fifth goal. And it's three of the four lines were really buzzing on offense. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the fourth line was not bad or anything, just not as dominant. And, you know, by the end of that period, you take a stupid penalty. Krebs took a stupid penalty that was also kind of ticky-tacky. Not a great call by the officials. They gave up a power play goal. Now you're within one. You have to sit without the whole intermission. Well, they came back out in the third period and looked incredible. They scored those three goals within the first 10 minutes and then sat on that lead. I mean, that's the kind of – I know it's not a very good team, as I just laid out, but that's the kind of mental toughness the Sabres haven't shown, even against bad teams like the Ducks, who they went 0-2 against this year. So it was good to see all that.
Absolutely agree. And just to give a – not a correction, but in addition to what I had mentioned before with the five skaters picking up multi-point efforts, there was actually four Sabres that had 3 points apiece, that being Paterka, Tuck, Thompson, and then Rasmus Dahlin. So all around, really great effort. The top line is really looking inspired. Continuing on our conversation that we had either last episode or the one before, JJ Paterka is just seamlessly fitting into that top line, and it is very much to the point now that I think we can safely pencil that in as the top line to start next year. Those three really seem to have a great consistency with each other on the ice. A lot of the things that made the line special when they had Jeff Skinner, it's just that Paterka plays a little bit of a different style of game that still meshes really well with Thompson and Tuck styles. On Jeff Skinner, oh my God, just putting one off the crossbar after a classic Jeff Skinner play where he pulls the puck around from behind the net, makes a move by a couple of guys, and he has Lindgren on his chest essentially, or falling over onto his chest, I should say, and just puts it off the crossbar. And overall, even though he didn't pick up a goal in this one, I thought that Skinner had a really solid game last night in terms of generating chances. He seemed really active. And again, I'm going to keep harping on this, I think, you know, through the offseason. I really don't believe that Jeff Skinner is completely over the hump now. I think that next year, even though we are maybe starting to see a bit of a decline in his game, I still think that there's a little bit more juice left in the tank. He has that style that should be conducive to being able to play into his 30s and be effective into his 30s. So we will see on that. But I thought that was really great. And Zach Benson as well. I think it's important to give him a shout out as well. He just continues to look stronger and stronger. It's kind of similar, I feel like, in a way to how Jack Quinn was looking down the stretch last year, where you had a lot of the flashes throughout the first, let's call it like 3/4 of the season, where it was like, okay, this guy we know is going to be good. You know, we've seen the steps being taken. If he's slowly getting there, you see him putting the game together a little bit more, while some of the traits are jumping out, like the tenacity on the forecheck, you know, being a certified little bastard, a lot of the creative playmaking ability there. You know, we've seen it in flashes, but it really feels like it's been a lot more consistent over this last stretch in terms of him kind of figuring out how to be a successful NHL player on a night-to-night basis. It's natural that, you know, this is his first go at playing a full NHL season and doing so as an 18-year-old drafted out of the top, outside the top five. It's an incredible accomplishment alone that he's been able to make it this far into the season. And I think really now we're starting to see him put it all together a bit more, and it makes me just so unbelievably excited for what's to come next year with him having a full season under his belt, having a full healthy Jack Quinn back, and hopefully a new coach. And that, I think, kind of leads us into the next part of this discussion, unless you have anything else you want to add on the game.
I would also like to shout out JJ Paterka, who is up to 28 goals, I believe, now. And he's tied, I think, with Tage for the team lead. Paterka, someone put out a list today of everyone who scored at least 28 goals in a season as a Sabre that was 22 or younger. And it was basically a list of most of the best Sabres forwards, and then also some guys who played in the 80s. No offense to John Tucker and Ray Shepard, but goals came a little easier back then.
They so, sure did.
Great to see that. So, yeah, the Sabres also, we've been talking about it, but last night was just a further example of the fact that the offense is either terrible or really dangerous in a lot of games. And the stat that I wanted to throw out there is I looked through their games last night and looked at the number they scored, number of games where they scored very little, a normal amount, or a lot. The NHL scoring rate this year is 6 goals a game. So it's normal for a team to have 3 goals, an individual team to have 3 goals, basically, in a game. Just over 3 is the average. 4 would be pretty normal for a game that you win, or I'd say more normal for a team that's supposed to be good. So 3 or 4 should be where the Sabres are most of the time. In fact, they somehow have scored 0 to 2 goals more often. They've done that 30 times than 3 to 4, which they've done 29. That shouldn't be the case. Getting shutout should be a huge outlier. 1 and 2, 1 goal should also be a pretty big outlier for a team with the Sabres scoring talent. And 2 goals should be, I guess, somewhat more common, but less common than 3 and 4. Nope, they've somehow done that more, which it's not impossible in this day and age. That's just an indication of a bad offense. Well, here's the issue with thinking that, because that indication right there, the first thing I said, that's the kind of thing you would expect of not quite a San Jose, Chicago, Anaheim level bad offense, but just above that, like Montreal or Columbus or someone like that. But they've scored at least 5 goals 17 times. They've scored at least 6 goals 5 of those times. 3 times they've scored 7, and they did have that 1-9 goal game against the Leafs. And I think you and I both know that in quite a few of those games, like last night, they were done scoring with 10 or more minutes left, and they just kind of were like, hey, let's close this thing out. So my main question is, what the hell? And I think I have an answer. It's something I've been thinking about last year. It's also something that our good friend Kevin, and former guest, he put it pretty succinctly. It's something I've been thinking about since the middle of last season. When teams figure them out, they have no answer. But when they don't get figured out, they have the talent to really score. And I agree. That's why I keep saying they're a talented team, despite the fact that they're like 17th in goals this year and they can't figure out the power play. Do you agree?
We talk about it so much and have been talking about it so much that I'm sure, well, maybe not, but it feels like with how much we talk about it that it's almost like we're using Granato as like a scapegoat here. But the fact of the matter is, as the tweet implies, they aren't able to adjust. That's what it feels like to me. When a team, quote unquote, figures them out or has an idea of how to stop them, that's on the coaching staff to be able to adjust their strategy accordingly. And I mean, again, the power play, it's on the staff. There's no other way around it. Of course, there has to be accountability on the players on both fronts here, but I don't know how you can look at that team on paper. Both units, mind you, both the first and second unit, with the talent that they have, and to look anywhere else other than the coaching staff. And also, it's a personnel thing too. I mean, my God, people were talking about it yesterday online, and it was a very noticeable thing. Zach Benson, first power play unit. It's about damn time.
Yep.
I just, for the life of me, cannot understand how the conversation, and not that it necessarily is, but could be anywhere other than coaching with this. You have the talent. You have premier players on your team, at least on the first unit. And there's been questionable decisions when it comes to the power play in terms of deployment, you know, putting out the second unit ahead of the first unit sometimes, the first unit only really getting like 40 or 45 seconds worth of the power play, the questions about personnel, obviously. But you have enough there that you should be able to make it work. And again, I just go back to the fact that I think it just does come back to Granato, that he doesn't have the ability to, or it's not one of his strengths to be able to make in-game adjustments. It feels like a lot of the time that he just gives them a game plan ahead of the game. And even if it's not working, they just stick to that and have to hammer that. And I think that's also very indicative, or I should say not indicative of, but I think that is shown by how clunky they look in the offensive zone sometimes, how clunky they get in the neutral zone, how they really don't seem to have a flow to their game. And that's very much because of the fact that these teams know how to make adjustments accordingly. They know how to defend against what the Sabres system is. And it just seems like time and time again, when faced with this, that the Sabres don't make adjustments. They continue to just hammer home the same strategy in the offensive zone and even in their breakouts as well. And then we're stuck watching them in these horrible, you know, 4-1, 5-1 games where it looks like everybody forgets how good they were last year offensively. Do you feel similarly? Do you feel like it is it's a coaching thing that Granato just doesn't have the ability to make these in-game adjustments? Or do you think that more of the blame should fall on the players for not being able to step up in those spots?
See, in situations like this, I think it's so weird to do the either or, because yeah, the players are the ones literally on the ice not stepping up in these spots. But Granato is kind of the one, you know, responsible for all those players. He's the guy that's supposed to answer the bell. And I guess what I would say generally is it depends on the situation, because we're talking specifically about the fact that when another team has a good strategy against them, or is just a good defensive team, they have the Sabres kind of number, and the Sabres, there's nothing they can do differently. And I think that's on the coach, no doubt about it. Like, that's on adjusting properly. But there's been a lot of situations this year where the Sabres have looked bad against bad teams, and or when they come out flat. And I know a lot of people put that on Granato, the coming out flat. I don't always think that. I think that's a little bit on the Sabres as well. So I think in those situations, you can put it more on the Sabres. With our discussion here today, the players, I mean, when I refer to the Sabres, what we're talking about here today, that's squarely on Granato. That's coaching. And we've seen in the NHL more times than I can count how different a team can look with different coaching. I know sometimes the joke in hockey is like, there's not plays. It's not like football or basketball. It's just like, hey, skate, those legs moving, get the puck, whatever. But like, it's obviously important. And you can see when occasionally when team fires a coach midseason, how different that is. That can be a night and day difference. In fact, you even saw that with Kruger to Granato. Just a few simple changes that a coach can make. Well, I think in this case, it's pretty clear that there needs to be a change, and not because Granato's some terrible coach like Kruger, or that it was a big mistake to bring him in or whatever. It's because you brought him in because you knew he'd be good with young guys. We had no evidence he was going to be a good NHL coach in the long term. He never coached as an NHL head coach before, even though he's been around for decades as a coach. He's always coached young guys. So that's why you brought him in. It made sense. He got an extension because his first contract was too short, basically, and the early returns were good. But you always know when you sign a contract extension to a guy that early. In fact, whenever you sign a contract extension for a coach, that you might have to eat part of it. That's part of the deal. So I think at this point, you this season especially, found out, well, he's not a good strategy coach. He's not a guy to bring him to the next level, which is the playoffs. Hard to disagree with that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. You're right. I mean, and I think the big thing is how they look over this final stretch affect what the front office wants to do heading into the offseason and moving forward here. I believe we only have 6 games left to go this season, and I would hope that they don't look at, you know, this upcoming 6-game stretch and look at that as like, okay, this is Granato trying to coach for his job or anything like that. I think they need to look at this season as a whole, and I really hope they do that. But I don't know. I just don't want them to go on a fake run here, and then that leads to Adams doing the whole, oh, well, we have Jack Quinn back healthy, and imagine when we have Matias Samuelson. So we want the continuity and keep the guys together. And it just, I just think that it would just be such a wasted opportunity. Again, we're talking about the 6th longest tenured head coach in the NHL right now, and the Sabres have not made the playoffs under him. And taking a step back points-wise this year is a failure. It should be treated as such. There's no consolation prize here. Like, this year, it sucked. It really did. It felt like all of the good vibes that were built up over the past few years, the goodwill, building momentum, you know, going towards the team, really was kind of culminating in this season, which felt like it was supposed to be the one where they were going to get over the hump. And they failed at their objective, flat out. They failed, and you need to be able to hold guys accountable. And I think that with what we're talking about here and the various other shortcomings of not only Granato, but this coaching staff, I just, any respectable organization, and I know that this is asking a lot of our Sabres, but any respectable organization would move on from their coach, yeah, given the circumstances.
I think, I don't even know if respectable is necessary there. I think everyone would just do it.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't do it? I don't know. There's not a lot of situations where, like, even the bad teams cycle through coaches all the time.
Well, and let's be real, too. I probably, you know, shouldn't get ahead of myself here, because the last 6 games that they have left aren't necessarily easy ones. Really, none of them are. You have Philly coming up on Friday. You have Detroit on Sunday. Those are 2 teams fighting for their playoff lives. You have Dallas, who's one of the best teams in the West. You have Washington then on the following Thursday, the 11th, again, one of the teams fighting for their lives right now in the playoff race. And then you finish off with Florida and Tampa. So not going to be a cakewalk by any means.
Yeah. Florida and Tampa might be locked into their spots by those last 2 games, but whatever. Doesn't really matter what's happening now. Brendan, I'm going to throw this out to you and then go to the break. So you think about it while we're talking about the ad.
Good deal.
Terry Pegula was in the house last night for the game. Was that for Jeff Skinner's 1,000th game or a different reason?
I think, as has been shown to us this morning, I think it was for a different reason.
All right, folks, let's hear a little word from our sponsor. We know hockey games move fast, but with DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NHL, you can score faster than anything happening on the ice. This week, new customers can bet $5 and get $200 instantly in bonus bets. So, for example, big Friday night game between the Sabres and Flyers. Really, it's big for the Flyers, not the Sabres. But it sure would be nice to ruin those Flyers' day. So if you want to get on the action, money line, puck line, over-unders, player prop bets, goals, who's going to score goals? Maybe a lot of guys, not a lot of good goaltending these days on the Flyers. Here's what you got to do. You got to download the DraftKings Sportsbook app with promo code THPN for the Hockey Podcast Network. New customers can bet just $5 on the NHL and get $200 instantly in bonus bets only on DraftKings Sportsbook with promo code THPN. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas, 21 plus, but age will vary by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.com/hockey for eligibility, deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources. NHL and the NHL Shield are registered trademarks of the National Hockey League. Copyright NHL 2024. All rights reserved. So, beyond the other news in Buffalo sports land today, do you think there's any chance Terry Pegula was up here in Buffalo, which he isn't always? Do you think, you know, he's coming out of his enclave in Florida? Do you think he's coming up here to do a lot of business, or just the business we know about, that the news that broke in the last hour about the Buffalo Bills?
I mean, I'd like to probably think that he flew into Buffalo yesterday morning, and just was walking around. And then somebody had just reminded him in passing, like, hey, you know, there's a hockey game tonight. And he was like, what? And I think he probably got reminded that he owned the Sabres. So good for him for being able to make it out to a game. Kudos to you, Terry. Job well done. But yeah, man, I am ready to talk about some Stefan Diggs here a little bit. This is a pretty massive move. Pretty massive move with a lot of implications. I feel like it's a unique trade where there's like a lot of bad that you can look at with it, but also there definitely is some silver linings, I think, as well. So I'd like to hear your thoughts first before I share some of mine. What do you make of the Bills trading Stefan Diggs to the Houston Texans for a second round pick next year, which belongs to the Vikings, and the Bills also sending a fifth and a sixth rounder?
Yeah, I think I've gone through multiple cycles on this already, and it's only been an hour. It's weird because one of the first things was like, well, you get the big cap relief this year and blah, blah, blah. Then it was like, wait, no cap relief. The dead cap hit, because he's a post-June 1st designation, is $31 million. So that's the biggest dead cap hit ever. It's only a second-round pick, and they had to give up a fifth and sixth to move him. When I saw that, I've gone multiple on that. I don't think that's very good. I don't think that's a move you have to make considering how big the dead cap is. And then for those that don't know, a dead cap hit is when a guy's not on your roster anymore and you have to pay him anyway. You pay him more than his actual cap hit to, I don't know, disincentivize training guys. I don't know. The NFL is weird. Usually that's a cut thing. I don't understand why that's a part of trades, but whatever. Maybe someone that knows more about that can explain that to me. Anyway, second, and you gave up a fifth and sixth. I don't know. That felt weirdly light, but I don't always understand NFL trade compensation. Basically, never. So that felt weird to me. The fact that it was the Texans, a team that, you know, was it not even played a playoff. They made it as far as the Bills last year in the playoffs. Now, they got spanked in the second round by the Ravens, but still, they won a blowout playoff game this year. They have a rookie quarterback. They're loading up for this quarterback's rookie deal. CJ Stroud is making a small number of millions of dollars. More money than us, but a lot less money than every other good quarterback. And he looks like he's the real deal right away. Their passing offense was awesome last year. They're probably going to, you know, they're going to go for it, and which is smart. You should be doing. You could basically not pay your quarterback and have him be like as good as any other quarterback in the league. What a deal. So that's tough. Like that they're in the AFC. Like this is, what if you lose in the playoffs to them? That could happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the other thing now. Now that we know all this, the whole hour of information, you didn't get a good return. You sent him away in the AFC. You traded him, frankly, at a time where people don't get traded as much. April 3rd? That's not like trade season. Trade season is, it's either past or it's at the draft. This is weird. Also, for what it's worth, the second round pick is next year's. The fact that they did all that makes me think it's more one thing than the other thing. And here's the two things it could be. One thing, it's just a continuation of the rest of this offseason where the Bills are going to take their medicine in 2024 so they can be better in 2025 and beyond. And I believe, but I'm not an expert on this, them taking the $31 million dead cap hit this year means it's, they don't have that going forward. But I think I'm right on that, but I don't know. I'm not going to say I'm 100% right. And the fact that they'll just have a lot of money and a lot of draft picks and a lot of young guys in 2025. And from then on, their cap situation will be sorted out and it won't be as much of a problem. If that was the case, why is the trade coming now? If that's the case, why did you have to trade him for a pretty amp return in the AFC to another contender?
But my thing is, though, like, how is it? Just in the sense that, let's be real, how many like good high-end years do you think that Diggs has left?
In terms of his peak, like on the Bills peak,
yeah,
zero. But in terms of mind like, you, I, 1,000 I, yard seasons, like two would be reasonable to me, two or three.
So I make that point or ask that question completely independent of the dead cap hit, because obviously that's tough, but this is where I am with it, where I'm in this back and forth, because on the one hand, it's definitely brutal taking that $31 million cap hit. But at the same time, everybody's been using the expression you just used it before, taking your medicine now. And let's be real here. The sooner that they were to do that, because it is inevitable that they were going to have to at some point or another, the better it is for the longevity of Josh's career. Like, if this is like the retooling year where you still compete, say maybe you get in a wild card spot, whatever, just because you have Josh, and then next year in 2025, you're poised to really be able to go out and kind of reshape what this team looks like as a contender, then I'm absolutely okay with that. And I mean, getting a second rounder again for a guy who is 30, maybe has one or two good years left. I don't know. I mean, were people really expecting that somebody was going to trade like a top 10 pick for Diggs?
No, I would. I was expecting either that you wouldn't have to give up picks back, or that you get more than one second, a second and a third.
I mean, I guess I don't know. I guess I just don't really know. I would have to see some comparable trades of receivers at this age. Because also the other side of this too, I think there's a few things here. For one, taking on a dead cap hit right now, it just screams that they wanted to get rid of him. And I think that there's several.
Yes, that was what I was building at for the second one.
Yeah,
he's becoming too much of a problem. Well, which I guess we might find out in the coming days.
Yeah, and let's talk about that a little bit, because I think you and I both were, at least I know I was, and feel free to tell me if you were didn't feel this way too, but there, of course, was a lot of smoke last season with regard to a lot of the throwing shade kind of comments that he was making in the media, and it was repeated. You know, we all know, like, the famous tweet where it's about, like, you know, how wide receivers are always, like, so cryptic compared to, with, like, their online presences as compared to other position players in the NFL. But it was a little bit more than that with Diggs, and I feel like he was last year, like, intentionally making comments or making suggestive remarks that were making people question how he felt about being on this team. Now, that is an indisputable fact that he was doing that, and there were two camps of people, main camps of people, probably three actually, who had responses to that. One were the delusional, way too online Bills fans who were like, no, it's fine. Everything is kumbaya. Nothing is wrong. Everything is great. Everything is fine and dandy, blah, blah, blah. Then I think there were people who were on the other end of that spectrum being like, he wants out. This is a disaster. Get him out of here. Furious with him. And then I think there was a lot of people who kind of fell somewhere in the middle, which is where I fell and I think where you fell, where it was acknowledging that he was making these comments. It was suggestive of him not being happy here, or however you want to phrase it. But at the end of the day, he's a wide receiver. He has a bit of a, not in a derogatory way, but like a diva personality. And
no doubt about it.
And it was just typical of his character. But at the end of the day, it's like the dude can ball still. Who cares if this is what we got to take, what we have to deal with for him and Josh to like be good and have him on the field and performing, it's fine. Like, as long as he's on the field and he's performing, that is okay. Now, with where we stand a year from that, or not even a full year from that, you not only have him making that tweet last night about how he was essential to Josh's success, which, like, I really didn't love, but also the guy finished the season in his last, what was it, like 12 or 13 games, was abysmal, absent, did not show up in the playoffs. Aside from, what was it, the Miami game? Abysmal. And in terms of it, not even like his entire playoff career with the Bills. He did not show up in the biggest moments. And he didn't show up in what would have been the biggest moment of his career when he dropped that deep ball against the Chiefs.
Yeah.
So for one, you don't have a right to talk shit when you yourself are not showing up in those moments. And on top of that, over like today and over these next few days, we're going to see all of this stuff about Diggs ranking in the top five of receiver statistics from 2020 to now. But that is looking at his career as a whole. When you get down to how he looked down the stretch last year, he was terrible. He did not show up. And while there was absolutely, I'll give him credit, because there were plenty of clips that came out and examples of him being a good leader on the sidelines, and I think trying to maybe dispel some of that stuff, the dude did not produce. He didn't produce in general for being a wide receiver one, but for being a wide receiver one who talks as much shit as he talks, he didn't produce. When he's talking shit and he's putting up, you know, consistent 80, 90, 100-yard games, catching a touchdown pass a game, please, blabber on all you want about how essential you are to Josh Allen's success. But when you are not showing up in the biggest moments, I don't want to hear it. And so him making that tweet yesterday, again, which was such a basic little petty tweet, that for me really felt like the I had completely jumped ship on trying to be understanding of the situation, just trying to say, this is a dude who he talks a lot of shit, but he's good and we need him. And this is just what he does. Like, for me, after how he ended last season on that last stretch, it was like game over, done. I don't want to hear that shit. Like, you have absolutely no right to be doing that. And especially the other part of this that I think is just really, really a big part of this, at least for me, it is now that I've kind of changed my tune on how I feel about Diggs, is it is undeniable that at every turn, Josh Allen has not left a shadow of a doubt about how he feels about Stephon Diggs. Diggs was putting himself in all of these situations. This entire mess, you can't blame the fans, you can't blame the media. This is a mess of Stephon Diggs' own creation. And at every turn, in front of the media, Josh Allen went to bat for this dude. Constantly, constantly saying how he was a key part of this team and that him and Steph are best friends and that what's most important is that they're able to work through this and that and the other. He went to bat for him over and over and over again. And how many times can you look at in the last year since all of like year and a half since this stuff started with all of the noise and everything from Diggs, how many times has he really outright given that back to Josh? Given saying Josh's praises in the way that Josh is saying his? Not much at all.
But not since like early 2022 season.
Exactly. Like, it's been a while. It's been a year and a half plus since he's been doing that. And so he's the one himself who is like stoking the flames and adding fuel to the fire while Josh has consistently tried to put it out. And it's just, I think the thing is for me is that I'm so frustrated about this right now and that things are ending this way and that I have these feelings about it because of the fact that Stephon Diggs undeniably is the best wide receiver. Maybe even we can go as far to say skill player that we have had on the Bills in my lifetime. You want to bring up like who would even be the comparable, like Eric Moulds? Like Moulds was great, but
you're
he
too
was
young.
Not. No, Moulds was great, but you
no,
mean to
Moulds
tell me he's
better.
Good as the he
Moulds,
was.
Moulds was better
as the best Stephon Diggs.
Moulds played with the last year of Jim Kelly, Todd Collins, Rob Johnson, Doug Flutie, and Drew Bledsoe, and then J.P. Lossman in his last year. He had 9,000 yards in 10 years as a Bill in the 90s and early 2000s. With those guys.
But was he as good at his best as Stephon Diggs was at his best?
No. But it's comparable. It's comparable
it,
for sure.
Okay, maybe I'm going
1,400 yards in the late 90s.
Okay, maybe I'm going a little too far with that, but Diggs at his best is the best skill player that I have seen in my lifetime as a Bills fan.
I think that's fair. Yeah, but it's close. Like, there's guys who are up there.
Regardless, and I think beyond that, too.
Like McCoy's up there, too.
He injected, though, such a much-needed level of coolness and swagger and energy into the building that team was sorely lacking. Sorely, sorely lacking. Sean McDermott has the swagger of a gallon of 2% milk. They just didn't have it. Josh was this dude who was drafted out of Wyoming, and McCoy obviously had a big part in the early formation of Josh kind of developing a little bit of that, like, dog and swagger himself. But Diggs was fundamental to not only Josh in the beginning and in the early goings, but just the way that this Bills team carried themselves. And he very quickly became, I think probably as soon as they traded for him, I felt like he was my favorite Bill. He has been my favorite. He's probably, I would say in terms of like the peak of the peak, maybe my favorite Bill of my lifetime. And it just fucking sucks that it's ending this way so unceremoniously in such a negative light, and that it's, again, a monster of his own creation. Like, things are the way that they are because of him. And I think for the Bills front office, the $31 million in dead cap sucks, but I don't blame them at all for being like, it's not even the fucking draft yet. We're not doing this again this offseason. Like, we're just not. Let's just take the medicine, do it now, and get it over with. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. So going back to last year, because he was basically, in my opinion, three straight years of like really good, not really good. He was great, elite receiver. And last year, it's easy to forget, he started out incredible. 10 catches for 102 yards and a touchdown week one. Week two, 7 catches on 7 targets. Week three, 8 catches for 111 yards. Week 4 against the Dolphins, 6 catches and 7 targets for 120 yards and 3 touchdowns. Then the Jacksonville game, 8 catches for 120 yards and a touchdown. The Giants game, 10 catches for 100 yards. And that's when things really fall off. And Brendan, the second half of this season, more than the second half, I guess the second two-thirds of this season, it's tough. 6 catches on 12 targets against New England. 9 on 12 targets against Tampa, but only for 70 yards, 0 touchdowns. 6 of 7 against the Bengals with a touchdown. That's not bad. Against Denver, 3 catches on 5 targets. Against the Jets, 4 on 8 targets. Against the Eagles, 6 and 11 targets. On KC, 4 on 11 targets. Against Dallas, 4 on 5 targets. The Chargers, 5 on 8 targets for 29 yards. Against New England, 4 on 7 targets for 26 yards. Finished strong against Miami with 7 targets on 8 yards. And then in the playoffs last year, 10 total receptions on 17 targets for 73 yards. No touchdowns. So after the Jacksonville game, which where he got his 5th touchdown, was averaging over 100 yards, he only had 3 touchdowns for the rest of the season. He had a touchdown on average about every 4 games after that. That's tough. I mean, the Bills' offense changed, no doubt, and Josh ran for a lot of touchdowns. But one of the so the offense changed under Joe Brady, no doubt about it. But you just heard me read those targets off. He got targets. And it wasn't just that he was getting low-depth targets and making the most of them. He was dropping passes constantly. He wasn't getting open to the same extent.
Yep.
So he wasn't as good. And I don't really hold that against him as much. He turned 30. I turned 30 not too long ago. It's not easy. Oof. So I get it. I if this was a business move, I think it made sense to bring him back for another year, all things considered. By all things, I mean the dead cap hit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like you, I'm just I can't that stuff has a shelf life. If you have to deal with playing with like Case Keenum and Sam Bradford and Kirk Cousins to start your career, and then all of a sudden you're like, man, I gotta get the hell out of here. I gotta get to a better team. I get it. And then you get Josh Allen, great. Now I'm not saying you should be happy with losing in the playoffs every year. You should be mad. But also I think in that, you know, look within. His playoff numbers, particularly in the losses the Bills have had, have not been great. And wide receivers are other position dependent. They're dependent on the quarterback. They're depending on how the offense runs and all that. But he did not show out in all of those games. And you mentioned the big drop against Kansas City. So I think there has to be – you can be mad, but be as mad at yourself as everyone else. There is no really better situation for Diggs out there. Maybe this is a good – he landed in one of the best situations he could go to, seemingly, with C.J. Stroud. But there wasn't all these options that they had. That he could have just upgraded with, like the get me the hell out of Buffalo thing. So I have a few more thoughts on that with the diva wide receiver thing. What annoys me with this is that you can't keep doing it your whole career.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're old enough that we've seen multiple guys roll through that are not roll through Buffalo, but roll through the NFL that are that kind of guy. Great, but difficult to deal with. And it mostly ends sad. Like Randy Moss is probably the best example of someone who is kind of survived that and weathered it. It partly is because he's the most talented receiver ever, and he has such a good personality that everyone likes him. He got a good ESPN job. But Randy Moss has 0 Super Bowls. Is Randy Moss – I don't know if he's in the Vikings Ring of Honor or whatever their version of it is, Ring of Honor, Wall of Fame. He should be. But he forced his way out of there, was a huge disappointment in Oakland. A lot of the reason was because of his own effort. He goes to New England and is incredible there, breaks records, forces his way out basically again, goes back to Minnesota and is cut weeks later, goes and plays for the Titans, which people might forget about. No positive memories for anyone in that interaction. Has to sit out a whole year because no one's interested in signing him until he takes a small amount of money to play for the 49ers his last year, another thing people may or may not remember. That's kind of a sad ending to his career. No Super Bowl wins, 2 Super Bowl losses. And then you look at Chad Johnson. Him bouncing around at the end of his career, no one wanted him. 0 Super Bowl wins. T.O., the best example. Yep. T.O. was like, he's a little less talented than Randy Moss, but pretty close, and was consistent. Just brought it game after game in a way that Randy Moss didn't. He was more refined, I would say, as a receiver. He could run way more routes. He has way more memorable playoff games. He just has his unbelievable run. Forces his way out of San Francisco and they get bad. All right. Goes to the Eagles. Forces his way out. Or has to get released for reasons that that was still super weird. It was a big clash of personalities. And then Dallas. And then the same thing happens in Dallas. And then where is he spending his mid-30s? Buffalo and Cincinnati. And then playing for the Allen Wranglers because no one wanted him. I mean, that's And then he has to wait a year to get into the Hall of Fame. And now he has no fan base in Killzone. T.O. can't go back anywhere. Chad Johnson, I guess, might still be big in Cincinnati. I don't know what big
I
moments
think
he's
he
part
is,
of.
Yeah.
I'm sure he is, but he's not going to the Hall of Fame. T.O. and Randy Moss are at least in the Hall of Fame. These things, they don't end great. And then, you know, when I kind of look at it a little bit more, like, the Bills have Kincaid. Hopefully they take a receiver in the first round. You know, the Super Bowl history of our lifetime, it is not littered with unbelievable receivers winning, leading their teams to Super Bowls. The first one I ever watched, awesome. Best Super Bowl core, or best Super Bowl of my life, was the first one I watched, the Rams and Titans. Best wide receiver core, Isaac Bruce, Torrey Holt, Ricky Prohl, Al-Azhar Hakeem. Unbelievable. But shit besides that, the Patriots have never had great receivers. And when they did, they had Wes Welker and Randy Moss. Their two best receivers of the Brady run, they didn't win Super Bowls. Their best receivers when they won Super Bowls were like Deion Branch and Troy Brown and Julian Edelman. And again, Gronk counts, but Gronk's not a receiver.
Mm-hmm.
Then you move on to who else has won. Well, the Eagles won the Super Bowl. They had pretty good receivers. They had like Jeremy Maclin and stuff. The Broncos won the Super Bowl in 2015. They couldn't even really throw the ball. The Seahawks won the Super Bowl with pretty good receivers. They didn't even need them, though, to win that Super Bowl. The Ravens in 2012, okay receivers. And then you look at like, okay, so Tyreek Hill was huge. Tyreek Hill and Sammy Watkins made huge catches in 2019 when the Chiefs won the Super Bowl. And then they got rid of Tyreek Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't really replace him with a good receiver. And they've won two Super Bowls. You have to be good at everything. Being good at receiver helps. But the best receivers of my life haven't won a lot of Super Bowls. All the ones I went over, I didn't even mention Larry Fitzgerald, who was unbelievable in the playoffs. He never won a Super Bowl either. So I was just saying with the Bills, that's a separate point than the Diggs thing. It's just been sticking in my craw that a lot of Buffalo media has talked about the fact that you need two good wide receivers to win the Super Bowl. You don't. Anyway, there has been obviously good examples. The 2021 Rams, sorry. But anyway, just getting back to the Diggs thing, it's if you're going to be a problem in the locker room, you're replaceable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to deal with you being a problem.
I mean,
as far
again,
as this actual Bill season, though, this coming upcoming Bill season, I'm not sure. This is a real take your medicine year.
It's going to be dicey, and I think it's going to be the kind of season that's going to say a lot about Josh, even though it may be unfair, the receiver room that he's going to be walking into. I think if Josh is still able to elevate them, then that's going to speak volumes about even further about the player that he is. The last thing I'll say on Diggs, a couple of things. The point you kind of made at the end there, it speaks volumes as to how much of a problem the Bills thought it was that they would rather have $31 million on the books for him to not be on the team than to have him on the team. And the other thing I'll say, I have been on this train for quite a while now, but I think they are poised to trade up. Go up to 9 and get Rome Odunze. Or if it's Neighbors that falls too, get up there. You just got the additional second from the Vikings next year. Maybe that'll help soften the blow of having to trade next year's first. But do one this year, one next year, second next year, and get the hell up to 9 and take Neighbors or Odunze, whoever's there. Do what you got to do to get one of the top three guys. I obviously Brian Thomas is going to be really good. Seemingly he's going to probably go in the teens somewhere around there, but I think you got to go for one of the top three. Swing for the fences right now. You can do it. You can afford to do it. And for me, like making that kind of an investment in a guy who is going to project to end up being a world-class elite wide receiver, getting 5 years of a rookie contract at this stage of Josh's career is going to prove to be invaluable. And you know that whether it is Harrison, Neighbors, or Odunze, that those guys are going to be studs. So make that investment now. One last final taking your medicine, but I'm more than okay with giving up next year's one if it means that we're locking in an elite receiver for 5 years and what is going to be, you know, the continuation of Josh being at his peak.
Absolutely. And I also, I would say with the dig stuff, I guess what kind of annoyed me is there's, you know, the little things, you know, we're all adults now. Now that I'm the same age as some aging players.
He's 30.
Yeah. But you gotta say it with your chest or shut the fuck up.
Yep.
You want to trade? Say you want to trade internally. or externally, whatever the hell. You don't want to trade? You're not happy with what's going on? Deal with it in there.
Yep.
When your moron brother says that you should be leaving and that Josh Allen wasn't shit without you, and then you get asked about it and you get defensive, like the media is coming after your brother, who, by the way, is a professional athlete speaking his own words on the public platform.
Yep.
You're like, don't talk about my family. Shut the fuck up.
Yep.
Say my brother's wrong. Say he's wrong.
Right. That's the thing. It's
he's
so
the one
easy.
Putting you in a bad situation.
Ugh.
The media and the fans and everyone else is not putting you and your brother in a bad situation. He's putting you in a bad situation. Text him and say, delete those fucking tweets and say, I want to be here. Or say, my brother's right. I don't want to be here.
Yep.
Say what you want. So
totally.
That's what I wanted to get mad at. I will say, despite how this sounds, I really enjoyed the digs there in Buffalo. He's a really cool guy. There's just things at the end I didn't love. And maybe in a few years, hopefully I'll look back if this is a really positive era. I mean, I think I definitely will. I think I'll still probably have positive feeling towards Diggs, but these things really annoyed me. And it's hard to like go off about it while he's still on the team because I'm still rooting for him. But it was tough. And I think what he said yesterday, it kind of annoys me because there's a narrative out there that's correct that Allen was it was his first 2 years. He wasn't great at all. He was getting better consistently, but through 2018 and 19, his numbers showed that. And they made the playoffs in 2019, but no one would have called him a great quarterback. No, I wouldn't even have ever thought he was going to be called a great quarterback no matter what was going to happen. And then Diggs showed up and it was different. That was good for getting him started. It's pretty obvious now, Diggs or no Diggs, that Allen's great. And I mean, the proof is in the pudding, and the pudding is the second two-thirds of last season. Allen was still consistently great. Allen had the fourth straight 40-yard touchdown, first ever 40-touchdown season, the first guy to ever do that. While Diggs was a pretty meh guy, catching less than half of his targets. Allen can be great without Diggs. It's clear. Diggs also, what annoyed me, though, is that Diggs was not considered a top five receiver until he played with Josh Allen. His best season, he had 9 touchdowns. His career high was 1,130 yards. You can't tell me because it's because of Kirk Cousins. Look at Justin Jefferson.
And that is exactly, I think, another avenue that he easily could have taken with any of these talking points or anything that he could have said. Like with the tweet from yesterday, why couldn't it have been I made Josh just as much as he made me? Like, we grew together. I am not responsible for him growing
more. It makes you
more.
Look small.
What's that?
It makes him look small.
Makes him look so
in general,
small.
It just
sucks. It's really shitty. Like it. And again,
and it
when you consider that Josh
stuff,
consistently was going to bat for him.
Yeah. I don't know.
Brutal, man. Just brutal. Well, we'll see what happens. The draft should be fun.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say. If they don't trade up to top 10, that's really the only thing that could save this offseason from a 2024 perspective. But hey, Josh Allen's still here and healthy. There's always something to build on. I just don't know if this upcoming season is going to be fun. Also, God, the Von Miller signing. In hindsight, what a bad bit of business that ended up being.
Yeah, we really couldn't have known.
One
at
full
the
healthy
time,
year,
though.
They might have won a Super Bowl. But
you really
they also
couldn't
might
have
not
known. You couldn't have known at the time, though. I
you
obviously hate it as much as the next person, but it's easy to say in hindsight. I just think that at the time it did make sense, and it was seemingly a good move, even though it was a lot of money with his age. He got hurt. He got hurt. Like, he had a bad injury. What do you, you know? Yeah. And he looked worth it prior to the injury. He absolutely looked worth the money.
Oh, no doubt about it. He looked incredible. I'm going to take back that they could have won a Super Bowl thing in 2022 because it was actually their offense that also fell apart in the second half.
Well, there you go. Any other thoughts before we sign off, Taylor?
Go Vols. Go Yankees, 5-1. Are we back?
Go.
No.
Folks,
we're not back.
Juan Soto is back, though. I'm telling you that.
God,
not
yeah,
that he ever left.
He's going to look so good for someone else next year.
I know. It makes
me
so
sad.
Get
the bag in L.A.
Man, you're talking about a team that desperately needed Swagger, getting a healthy injection of it. Holy shit, man. He's bringing it to the Yankees right now. And is there any way that they can re-sign him?
Oh, 100%, yeah. They're the favorite to re-sign him. I'm being facetious. The Dodgers have too much money tied up in other guys. They're not going to sign Soto.
True.
I mean, yeah, just offer him whatever. He's great at everything. He's super young. Offer him 10 years, $500 million or whatever the hell.
Love it. Sign me up. All right, everybody. Well, thanks for tuning into this episode of Straight Up Sabres presented by the Hockey Podcast Network and the Charging Buffalo. Make sure you're checking out both the presenters of this podcast on their respective websites, whatever streaming platform you're currently using to listen to this episode. Make sure you're checking out all of our fellow shows and make sure you're following both the Charging Buffalo and Hockey Podcast Network on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where you can also find us, Straight Up Sabres. And before you close out of this app, whatever it is you're using to listen to this episode of Straight Up Sabres, make sure you are either following or subscribed to us, and we would very much appreciate it if you'd leave us a nice rating or review. Last but not least, again, folks, we have our lovely, wonderful sponsor. That would be DraftKings Sportsbook. Use that promo code THPN at checkout to take advantage of great deals. We will be back with a brand new episode on Monday, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been Straight Up Sabres. Sitting on the bedroom floor, I am